coffee table. She hadn't seen it make its escape, and I pondered whether or not to tell her. It was about me, after all, so wasn't it technically mine? I'd return it at the next visit, of course. I'm not a thief. I imagined Mummy's voice whispering, telling me I was quite right, that social workers were busybodies, do-gooders, nosy parkers. June Mullins snapped the elastic band around the file, and the moment to mention the sheet of paper had passed. Is there anything else you'd like to discuss with me today? She asked. No, thank you, I said, smiling as broadly as I could. She looked rather disconcerted, perhaps even slightly frightened. I was disappointed. I'd been aiming for pleasant and friendly. Well, then that seems to be that for the time being, Eleanor. I'll leave you in peace, she said. She continued talking as she packed away the file in her briefcase, adopting a breezy, casual tone. Any plans for the weekend? I'm visiting someone in hospital, I said. Oh, that's nice. Visits always cheer a patient up, don't they? Do they? I said. I wouldn't know. I've never visited anyone in hospital before. But you've spent a lot of time in hospital yourself, of course, she said. I stared at her. The imbalance in the extent of our knowledge of each other was manifestly unfair. Social workers should present their new clients with a fact sheet about themselves to try to redress this, I think. After all, she'd had unrestricted access to that big brown folder, the bumper book of Eleanor, 2 decades' worth of information about the intimate minutiae of my life. All I knew about her was her name and her employer. If you know about that, then you'll be aware that the circumstances were such that the police and my legal representatives were the only visitors permitted, I said. She gulped at me. I was reminded of those clowns' heads in fairgrounds, the ones where you try to throw a ping-pong ball into their gaping mouths in order to win a goldfish. I opened the door for her, watching her eyes swivel repeatedly towards the giant, customised frog. I'll see you in 6 months then, Eleanor, she said reluctantly. Best of luck. I closed the door with excessive gentleness behind her. She hadn't remarked upon Polly, I thought, which was odd. Ridiculously, I felt almost slighted on Polly's behalf. She'd been sitting in the corner throughout our meeting and was clearly the most eye-catching thing in the room. My beautiful Polly, prosaically described as a parrot plant, sometimes referred to as a Congo cockatoo plant, but always known to me in her full Latinate glory as Impatiens Niamnamensis. I say it out loud, often, Niamnamensis. It's like kissing, the M's forcing your lips together, rolling over the consonants, your tongue poking into N's and over the S. Polly's ancestors came all the way from Africa originally. Well, we all did. She's the only constant from my childhood, the only living thing that survived. She was a birthday present, but I can't remember who gave her to me, which is strange. I was not, after all, a girl who was overwhelmed with gifts. She came with me from my childhood bedroom, survived the foster placements and children's homes, and like me, she's still here. I've looked after her, tended to her, picked her up and repotted her when she was dropped or thrown. She likes light, and she's thirsty. Apart from that, she requires minimal care and attention and largely looks after herself. I talk to her sometimes, I'm not ashamed to admit it. When the silence and the aloneness press down and around me, crushing me, carving through me like ice, I need to speak aloud sometimes, if only for proof of life. A philosophical question. If a tree falls in a forest and no one is around to hear it, does it make a sound? And if a woman who's wholly alone occasionally talks to a pot plant, is she certifiable? I'm confident that it is perfectly normal to talk to oneself occasionally. It's not as though I'm expecting a reply. I'm fully aware that Polly is a houseplant. I watered her, then got on with some other household chores, thinking ahead to the moment when I could open my laptop and check whether a certain handsome singer had posted any new information. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, windows into a world of marvels. While I was loading the washing machine, my telephone rang. A visitor and a phone call. A red-letter day indeed. It was Raymond. I rang Bob's mobile and explained the situation to him, and he dug out your number from the personnel files for me, he said. I mean, really? Was all of me on show in buff folders, splayed wide for anyone to flick open and do with as they wished? What a gross abuse of my privacy, not to mention an offence against the Data Protection Act, I said. I'll be speaking to Bob about that next week. There was silence on the other end of the line. Well, I said. Oh, right, yeah, sorry, it's just you said you would call and you didn't, and, well, I'm at the hospital now. I wondered, you know, if you wanted to bring the old guy's stuff in. We're at the Western Infirmary. Oh, and his name's Sammy Tom. What? I said. Well, now that can't be right, Raymond. He's a small, fat, elderly man from Glasgow. There is absolutely no possibility of him being christened Sammy Tom. I was beginning to develop some serious concerns about Raymond's mental capacities. No, no, Eleanor. It's Sammy, as in short for Samuel, Tom, as in T-H-O-M. Oh, I said. There was another long pause. So, like I said, Sammy's in the Western. Visiting starts at 7, if you want to come in. I said I would, and I'm a woman of my word, Raymond. It's a bit late now. Tomorrow, early evening, would suit me best, if that's acceptable to you. Sure, he said. Another pause. Do you want to know how he's doing? Yes, naturally, I said. The man was an extremely poor conversationalist and was making this whole exchange terribly hard work. It's not good. He's stable, but it's serious. Just to prepare you, he hasn't regained consciousness yet. In that case, I can't imagine he'll have much use for his iron brew and lawn sausage tomorrow, will he? I asked. I heard Raymond take a breath. Look, Eleanor, it's entirely up to you whether you visit or not. He's in no rush for his stuff, and I guess you should throw out anything that won't keep. Like you say, the poor old soul isn't going to be making a fry-up any time soon. Well, quite. In fact, I imagine that fry-ups are exactly what got him into this situation in the first place, I said. I've got to go now, Eleanor, he said, and put the phone down rather abruptly. How rude. I was on the horns of a dilemma. There seemed little point in travelling to the hospital to see a comatose stranger and drop off some fizzy pop at his bedside. On the other hand, it would be interesting to experience being a hospital visitor, and there was always an outside chance that he might wake up when I was there. He'd rather seem to enjoy my monologue while we were waiting for the ambulance. Well, insofar as I could tell, given that he was unconscious. As I was pondering, I picked up the fallen page from the file and turned it over. It was slightly yellowed around the edges and smelled institutional, metallic, like filing cabinets, and grubby, touched by the unwashed skin of multiple anonymous hands. Banknotes have a similar odour, I've noticed. Department of Social Work. Note of case meeting. 15th of March, 1999, 10 a.m. Case meeting, Oliphant, Eleanor, 12:07, 1987. Present, Robert Brocklehurst, Deputy Head, Children and Families, Social Work Department. Rebecca Scatcherd, Senior Caseworker, Social Work Department. Mr. and Mrs. Reed, Foster Carers. The meeting took place at the home of Mr. and Mrs. Reed, whose children, including Eleanor Oliphant, were at school at the time. Mr. and Mrs. Reed had requested the meeting, which was out with the regular scheduled sessions, in order to discuss their growing concerns about Eleanor. Mrs. Reed reported that Eleanor's behaviour had deteriorated since it was last raised at a case meeting some 4 months earlier. Mr. Brocklehurst requested examples, and Mr. and Mrs. Reed cited the following. Eleanor's relationship with their other children had almost completely broken down, particularly with John, 14, the eldest. Eleanor was insolent and rude to Mrs. Reed on a daily basis. When Mrs. Reed attempted to discipline her, for example, by sending her upstairs to the spare room to reflect on her behaviour, she had become hysterical and, on one occasion, physically violent. Eleanor had, on occasion, pretended to faint in an attempt to avoid being disciplined, or else in response to being disciplined. Eleanor was terrified of the dark and kept the family awake with hysterical crying. She had been provided with a nightlight and reacted with violent sobbing and tremors to any suggestion that she should give it up, being too old for it now. Eleanor often refused to eat the food which was provided for her. Mealtimes had become a source of conflict at the family table. Eleanor refused point blank to assist with simple household chores, such as lighting the fire or clearing out the ashes. Mr. and Mrs. Reed reported that they were extremely concerned about the effects of Eleanor's behaviour on their other three children, John, 14, Eliza, 9, and Georgie, 7. And in light of these concerns, and also those raised previously during scheduled case meetings, they wished to discuss the best way forward for Eleanor. Mr. and Mrs. Reed again requested more information about Eleanor's past history, and Mr. Brocklehurst explained that this would not be possible and indeed was not permitted. Miss Scatcherd had sought a school report from Eleanor's head teacher in advance of the meeting, and it was noted that Eleanor was performing well, achieving excellent grades in all subjects. The head teacher commented that Eleanor was an exceptionally bright and articulate child with an impressive vocabulary. Her class teachers had reported that she was quiet and well-behaved during lessons, but did not participate in discussions, although she was an active listener. Several members of staff had noticed that Eleanor was very withdrawn and isolated during break times, and did not appear to socialise with her peers. After lengthy discussion and in light of the concerns raised and re-emphasised by Mr. and Mrs. Reed about the impact of Eleanor's behaviour on their other children, it was agreed that the most appropriate course of action would be to remove Eleanor from the family home. Mr. and Mrs. Reed were content with this outcome, and Mr. Brocklehurst informed them that the department would be in touch in due course regarding next steps. File note. On the 12th of November 1999, a children's panel review of compulsory supervision order concerning Eleanor Oliphant took place, at which Mr. Brocklehurst and Miss Scatcherd were present. Minutes attached. The children's panel concluded that, on account of Eleanor's challenging behaviour in this and previous placements, foster care in a family environment was not appropriate at the current time. It was therefore agreed that Eleanor should be placed in a residential care home for the time being, and that the decision of the panel would be reviewed in 12 months. Action. Ask Scatcherd to investigate availability of places and local facilities and notify Mr. and Mrs. Reed of expected date of removal. Ask Scatcherd, 12/11/99.
Liars. 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 Liars.
Chapter 7. The bus was quiet and I had a seat to myself, the old man shopping sitting in two bags for life beside me. I'd thrown out the sausages and the orange cheese, but I kept the milk for myself, reasoning that it wasn't stealing as he wouldn't be able to use it anyway. I had some qualms about throwing out the other perishable items. I do understand that some people think waste is wrong, and after careful reflection I tend to agree, but I'd been brought up to think very differently. Mummy always said that only peasants and grubby little worker ants worried about such trivial things. Mummy said that we were empresses, sultanas and maharanis in our own home, and that it was our duty to live a life of sybaritic pleasure and indulgence. Every meal should be an epicurean feast for the senses, she said, and one should go hungry rather than sully one's palate with anything less than exquisite morsels. She told me how she'd eaten chili-fried tofu in the night markets of Kowloon, and that the best sushi outside of Japan could be found in Sao Paulo. The most delicious meal of her life, she said, had been char-grilled octopus, which she'd eaten at sunset in an unassuming harbourfront taverna one late summer evening on Naxos. She'd watched a fisherman land it that morning, and then sipped ouzo all afternoon while the kitchen staff battered it again and again against the harbour wall to tenderise its pale, suckered flesh. I must ask her what the food is like where she is now. I suspect that lapsang souchong and long de sha biscuits are in short supply. I remember being invited to a classmate's house after school. Just me. The occasion was tea. This was confusing in itself. I had, not unreasonably, been expecting afternoon tea, whereas her mother had prepared a sort of early kitchen supper for us. I can still picture it. Orange and beige. Three luminous fish fingers, a puddle of baked beans, and a pale pile of oven chips. I'd never seen, let alone tried, any of these items, and had to ask what they were. Danielle Mearns told everyone in the class next day, and they all laughed and called me Beans Means Weird, shortened to Beansy, which stuck for a while. No matter, school was a short-lived experience for me. There was an incident with an over-inquisitive teacher who suggested a trip to the school nurse, after which Mummy decided that said teacher was a barely literate monolingual dullard whose only worthwhile qualification was a certificate in first aid. I was homeschooled after that. At Danielle's house, her mother gave us each a munch-bunch yoghurt for pudding, and I snuck the empty pot into my school bag so that I could study it afterwards. Apparently it was merchandise pertaining to a children's television programme about animated pieces of fruit, and they said I was weird. It was a source of disgust to the other children at school that I couldn't talk about TV programmes. We didn't have a television. Mummy called it the cathode carcinogen, cancer for the intellect. And so we would read or listen to records, sometimes playing backgammon on Mahjong if she was in a good mood. Taken aback by my lack of familiarity with frozen convenience food, Danielle Mearns' mother asked me what it was that I usually had for tea on a Wednesday night. There's no routine, I said. But what kind of things do you eat generally? She asked, genuinely puzzled. I listed some of them. Asparagus velouté with a poached duck egg and hazelnut oil. Bouillabaisse with a homemade riz. Honey-glazed poussin with celeriac fondants, fresh truffles when in season, shaved over seps and buttered linguine. She stared at me. That all sounds quite fancy, she said. Oh no, sometimes it's just something really simple, I said, like sourdough toast with manchego cheese and quince paste. Right, she said, exchanging a glance with little Danielle, who was gawping at me, revealing a mouthful of partially masticated beans. Neither spoke, and Mrs. Mearns placed a glass bottle of thick red liquid on the table, which Danielle then proceeded to shake violently and slather all over the orange and beige food. Of course, after I was taken into care, I rapidly became acquainted with a new culinary family. Aunt Bessie, Captain Birdseye, and Uncle Ben all featured regularly, and now I can distinguish HP sauce from Daddy's by smell alone, like a sauce sommelier. It was one of the innumerable ways in which my old life and my new life differed. Before and after the fire. One day I was breakfasting on watermelon, feta and pomegranate seeds. The next I was eating toasted mother's pride smeared with margarine. That's the story Mummy told me, at any rate. The bus stopped right outside the hospital. There was a shop on the ground floor selling an eclectic assortment of goods. I was aware that it was very much the done thing to take a gift when visiting a patient, but what to purchase? I didn't know Sammy from Adam. Comestibles seemed pointless, since the purpose of my visit was to bring him his own food, items that he'd only very recently selected for himself. Given that he was in a coma, reading material seemed somewhat irrelevant. There wasn't much else that might be suitable, however. The shop carried a small range of toiletries, but it seemed inappropriate for me, a stranger of the opposite